to F off, F off, F off, to F off, F back to Russia, to Russia, back to Russia, F off, back to Russia.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana, broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, 88.3 WRCT Radio, Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM Bush Radio, the mother of community radio in Cape Town, South Africa. This is the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert in New York, and we are joined today by Bud Williamson. Bud, thank you so much for coming on our show today.
Hey, anytime, Ricky.
So, Bud, before we get into it, basically explain to the listening audience what your career has been like in radio. Give us a little bit of a Reader's Digest version, and we'll dive more into it during the program.
Oh, wow. I've been in radio since I was, I want to say, about 17. You know, grew up listening to radio. I grew up on Long Island, and I remember always tuning in and listening to radio, AM, FM, moved upstate New York in 1973, 1974, and kind of a culture shock, and radio became my friend because where we went to in upstate New York was really rural compared to being in a development on Long Island. So I listened to the radio more up there. I'm in upstate New York now, and also put up some antennas outside so I can DX and listen to like Philadelphia radio, Binghamton, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre. And, you know, that was going through the 70s and the early 80s. Yeah, I'm old. So that's what really got me interested, is really that connection of one to many and that relationship, something that we've kind of lost today. So the first step, the first job I tried to get was to be on the air. And kind of a funny story, I went to the local station in Port Jervis, New York, WDLC. And for about a year, I would do demo tapes. And Ricky, let me tell you, I sucked. It was bad. I was horrible. You know, as I listened to those, and I was ready to give up. And because at that point, I was still in school. So I would take the school bus or different school bus over and get dropped off at the radio station, do a demo tape. And then one of my parents would pick me up, take me home. And it was getting to the point where it was a little... it was just continuing, and I felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. My dad said, "Ah, maybe this isn't for you." I said, "Yeah, so let me just do this week. I'll do the tape, see what they think of it, and then I'll move forward on another idea." When I finished that tape, they said, "Okay, hey, we're gonna put you on the air tomorrow night. Can you do this weekend tomorrow night, 5 to whatever? Sign off and Sunday morning." That was my start. I was so excited. Started working on the air again. I wasn't perfect. That's why you don't hear me on the air now. I mean, I continued on the air. I enjoyed it. I worked with some really good people who trained me and developed me on that side, and then worked in Middletown, New York, when Cousin Brucey owned Wall Radio. That was an experience as well. Went through there, and then it was in the early 80s, I want to say 83, I went to work for a company in Poughkeepsie, New York, owned by Rob Dyson, and got to work with an engineer who I consider a mentor, Dave Groth, who taught me a lot of things, what to do, what not to do, et cetera. And that was my full-time entry into engineering. And through the 90s and into the 2000s, with deregulation and the multiple ownership rules changing, stations were buying and selling. So we would end up moving those stations, consolidating them in other facilities. Digital audio automation systems were becoming big at that point, and many of the smaller market stations were embracing that technology. We would go around installing and programming those systems for people. Then we continued growing and getting bigger, ended up doing a lot of work with large groups through the 2000s as they were really continuing on their consolidation. The multiple ownership rules allowed them to buy up a number of stations and in a town, and we put them all into one facility, many times in a new facility. And there were grand plans at that point, and there was plenty of money to support this at the time. So we did that. HD radio was in its infancy and got developed in the early 2000s, even earlier. It was developed earlier, but the rollout with the non-coms especially started, and we went through training on digital radio and installing those transmitters and setting them up. We did that. Keep in mind, Ricky, this was all mostly analog based, or if they were digital audio systems in the studios, they weren't audio over IP as we have now, where things run over a Cat 5 cable. So once we got to the early 2010s, the landscape changed as far as the scale of some of these projects. So one of our last big projects, we did Fox Radio, News Radio in DC, and we did CBS Broadcast Center at 345 Hudson Street in New York City. So we did a design and build on that. And those were large projects, and they were fun to do. And we got to work with different manufacturers and develop those relationships. It was a great time. And then in the early 2010s, I had already been buying and selling signals, and actually bought the first station that I worked at, which was WDLC, and its FM. A few years later, in 2015, my wife and I bought Wall Radio up here in Middletown. So we've got a group of stations here. And we also have Hudson Valley Public Radio, which is a non-commercial station that Andy Ladding, as you know, is involved with me on, because he's one of our officers in Hudson Valley Public Radio, which is a 501c3. And that's kind of where I come from. I'm just a radio guy, and I've loved it and have done a lot of things. Right now, I do a lot of work with Geo Broadcast Solutions. I like staying on the cutting edge of technology. They have a booster technology that works in the process of getting sites together for them in a couple of markets to exploit that technology and gain results. With our stations, Andy and I just started a collaboration between KZE and my company, Neversink Media Group. This will grow, but right now we're putting our selling effort together, and integrating our programming effort for scale. So my station, Wall Radio, covers the Hudson Valley. We have other stations over in Port Jervis, Pike County, Pennsylvania. Andy is in Dutchess County and Northwest Connecticut, and our goal is to tie it all together. We can do that. And so that's our next project. So it's in process now. We launched it beginning of the year. We made our first hire of a creative general sales manager, and it's been a crazy couple of weeks here.
You mentioned before about buying stations and owning and running stations. What, when you're, the buck stops here at a radio station, what kind of style, sound, image did you want to put into your stations that you have executed over the last few years?
That's a great question, because that is what it's about. What this comes down to, content. And for those people that think radio is dying, or it is changing, the landscape is changing, because by way of the internet and cellular technology, wireless technology, we have the ability to hear so many different programming sources. So it really comes down to content. Our stations provide localized content. We're playing, in the case of Wall Radio, we have a classic hits format, which is very comfortable for listeners. And we have hosts on, disc jockeys, whatever you want to call them. They get to relate with the audience. Part of what happened through, as we went through the 90s into the 2000s and the 2010s, radio became more homogenized. There's less emphasis on the personalities and more emphasis just placed on the station and driving listenership to podcasts or other apps that may just play music. These are things that these companies are doing to generate revenue. In our case, we focus on the listener, respecting the listener, and local businesses too. We need to support our local businesses that advertise and are trying to survive in these markets as well. So local businesses have a similar problem where, whether it's a hardware store or a restaurant, they're competing with the chains that came in. They're competing with the Home Depots, competing with Olive Garden and other restaurants as well. So we have to make them stand out. What makes them better? And these are all things that we work hard to do and have had great success doing. And how do we measure that? We measure that in the feedback we get from our listenership and from our businesses that tell us, hey, this is great. We love listening. I feel like it's part of the family.
Discuss this idea of keeping local radio local with the businesses and the advertisers, the personalities. Describe the impact it has on that local audience and the community engagement.
It starts when I sit down with the prospective host and the people we have on Wall Radio as an example. They're people I've worked with before, with maybe one exception. Some of them have even worked at Wall Radio in the past, but they knew the value of having that relationship with listeners and with local businesses. So when we launched Wall Radio 10 years ago, the host that we brought on already knew the area, can talk about the area, can talk about things to do in the area, and they knew people in the community organizations, the church groups, the churches, the towns, and the cities. And so we became, at that point, really a source of what's going on in the county. And then we do the same thing with the businesses. So it's those hosts that create the fabric, complete the package, if you will, of the heart and soul of Wall Radio. We work hard. It's a lot more difficult today to work in this business than it was before, especially on the selling side. That once you get into ownership, you will realize that it's not just about programming, but there's engineering, there's the business side, paying the bills, and of course, the selling side. The selling is where you generate your revenue. We have a policy, as an example, of our breaks during normal programming will be short. We usually don't go more than 2 minutes on a commercial break. Why? Because if we go more than 2 minutes, the feeling is the listener is not going to remember what that commercial was about, what that message in that commercial was about. And the other larger stations and larger groups sometimes do, and I've counted on my fingers as I drive listening to their commercial breaks, they'll do a 12-minute break and sometimes have 15, 18 elements in that break, varying between 15 seconds, 30 seconds, 60 seconds. At the end of the commercial break, when it goes back to music, my recollection is very poor of what was in there. Therefore, we try to provide value to those businesses because they need that support as well.
You also own Hudson Valley Public Radio, because we're talking about sellers. What's the difference between running something that's commercial like Wall versus something like Hudson Valley Public Radio?
So Hudson Valley Public Radio was launched, I want to say 2014, when there was an opportunity to acquire a local non-commercial station. I didn't want it to go off the air, and I felt the value that it can be to the community. We put a jazz format on it. We had a lot of listenership. The problem was the model in which support and revenue can be generated for non-commercial stations. Some of these larger stations, I'm going to use New York Public Radio, WNYC, WQXR, there's WBGO here in the New York area, and there are countless other great public radio operators, but much of their revenue comes from underwriting, from grants, and from listener donations. We didn't really have a lot of underwriting because that takes effort to go and get. We had some listener donations, but it fell short. So we were still funding Hudson Valley Public Radio out of Neversink. And just so you understand, Hudson Valley Public Radio is a 501c3 corporation. So I'm not, in theory, an owner of it, but really there are officers in that type of organization. So that's where it gets a little different when you get to the non-commercial and the nonprofit world. And we have found the selling can be more difficult on that because selling underwriting announcements on a non-commercial station. So the FCC rules prohibit a call to action. That is one of the major differences between commercial radio, where we can say, stop in now, take a look at these cars. We can't say that on a non-commercial station. We could say the car dealership has all of these cars. So those are some of the main differences, that the call to action, getting that message across and that value to the business. There are businesses that supported the public radio station, and they're not in it necessarily to get people to come in the door. They're in it because they want to do good and support something for the community. So they want their name to be associated with that and to be a part of it. We'll talk about what that business does and what they have, but it's a different model where essentially we're not, in that case, not selling their product, but we are making people aware of that business and what they do. And the audience then makes up their mind that, okay, this is a business I want to go and visit, perhaps in part because they support the public radio station.
There was something I was reading about. You work with a lot of translators with your station, correct? Explain
So,
ex explain why and how that works for us.
wow. Oh, so different classes of, we'll say, FM stations at this point. So there are larger in the Northeast here of the United States, there are Class B stations, which are essentially 50,000 watt stations. And then there are Class A stations, which can be 3 or 6,000 watts. And then if you get further upstate New York and even into New England, there are Class C stations, 100,000 watt stations. And once you go out west, there are different, they have more Class C stations out there. And then they've even divided up Class C's out there. It gets pretty complex, but just think in mind 153 or 6 kilowatts. And there's also another classification called a B1, which is a 25,000 watt station. So on FM, these stations are separated. The allocation of these stations, whether they will fit, is determined by distance separations between transmitter sites. If you want to be on, let's say, 101.5, you could be on 101.5 here in Poughkeepsie, New York, and there won't be another 101.5 until you get a certain distance, a kilometer distance away. In the non-com band, it gets a little different. We use contour protection. So we just draw contours on maps, and that's how we protect those other stations. There are certain contours that we protect. So in the Northeast, as an example, it's pretty packed, and many stations are short spaced if you go by those distance separations now. There's a 101.1 in the Philadelphia market that's short spaced with 101.1 in New York City. So you go down the New Jersey Turnpike, and all of a sudden you start picking up both stations. It's kind of annoying, but that's the grandfathering that took place to allow some of these stations to increase power over the years. Where does translators come into this? Translators were designed to extend and provide service to a more localized area. In the early 2000s, there was a window open to allow people to file for translators, and it got pretty speculative at that point. And I got into that as well, and because I have the knowledge, I had the software, I had the technology, do the work to determine where these signals can be. And translators are all based on contour protection. So once you're this close to New York City, you can't just fit in another Class A or Class B radio station. I should say the Northeast. It's very, very difficult. Very difficult. So translators became a way of providing additional radio service and programming services. Some of it by rebroadcasting in an existing station. As we grew through the 2000s into the 2010s, we put HD channels on those analog FM translators, and we also put AM stations on those FM analog translators. So it's become another method of creating a service for the public, and it's worked. This is essentially what wall radio is, believe it or not. Wall is WALL, if you look it up, is an AM station in Middletown, New York on 1340 with 1,000 watts. And there are many people that still listen to that station, to that frequency, since it's been on the air since 1942. But we have, I believe, eight translators throughout the Hudson Valley that vary in power up to the maximum of 250 watts that blanket the Hudson Valley and provide coverage from all the way from Port Jervis through Orange County into Ulster County to Dutchess County as well. And we're also on an HD2 channel of WPDH, which is a 101.5, which is a Class B station. So wherever you go in the Hudson Valley, you can hear wall radio. The only disadvantage is people need to know sometimes when they drive from one area to another that another frequency may work better. And this happens with larger networks anyway. It's just our circles can be a little bit more, could be a little bit smaller. But our audience has educated themselves on where they can hear wall radio on all of those frequencies. So we essentially took a bunch of translators and built another radio station out of it by following the letter of the FCC rules to do that. And that's where FM translators can work. In many markets, they've been used. I'm going to use Albany as an example. They rebroadcast an HD2 channel, which has a, I believe that's got a hip hop format on it. Again, they couldn't fit another full power radio station up there, one of those Class A, B, or Cs. So there's a translator that is a different class of station that rebroadcasts that HD2 channel. That's where most of the listenership is, and it rates very highly in the Albany market. So there are some cases where I can design an FM translator to perform better than even a Class A station would perform, just because of the how the rules work. It's a little complex, but that's a pretty quick view of how translators work and how they can be successful.
And see, I learned something today because I'll say this without fear of sounding ignorant. When I first read translators, I thought it was translating a station in a foreign language. That's why it's good to do the show. I learn a lot.
Yeah, I'm not sure where the word translator came up, probably because it was translating from one frequency to another.
That's
So,
exactly what it was. That's why they used the term.
yes.
But that's how I originally read it. I said, that's interesting, but I learned something.
So we rarely call them, I mean, officially they're called translators today, but it's an outdated term. Just as much of the FCC rules are outdated and they recognize it, but it's difficult to just go and change the FCC rules because of how they go through the process of doing that, taking public comment, et cetera, et cetera. Really, the early days of FM translators were very strong out in the Midwest and the West, where they would pick up a distant signal and then rebroadcast it to a smaller community. So they would receive, let's say, a frequency of 94.1, and then they would rebroadcast it on, let's say, 95.7. And I'm just making up these numbers. And so that local audience in that community where that translator was located was able to hear that more distant station because it was received and rebroadcast over the air. And it, similar to what the cable companies did as they developed through the 50s, where smaller communities further away from, say, New York City and away from Pittsburgh, there are people that say, hey, if I put these TV antennas up on top of this mountain and then I run coax cable down into the community in the valley, I can hook up everybody's house to that big antenna. And that's how cable TV was born. And at that point, people were able to get Pittsburgh TV as an example, or New York TV. Started off with the off-air signals, and then with satellite delivery in the 70s, 80s, as that was developing, HBO was born. And that was one of the first services, a premium paid subscription service that was put onto cable TV.
See, I learned something. Something else, Bud, that you're also very involved in is the Society of Broadcast Engineers. And you mentioned earlier in the program, I think this would be the opportunity for you to discuss it. You and Andy Gladding, who created this show that we're on right now and is the chief engineer here at Radio Hofstra University, are trying to get more young people, more students involved in the Society of Broadcast Engineers. Explain what the society is and your effort to get more young people involved.
So the Society of Broadcast Engineers has been around a long time. It is a staple in the broadcast community that allows broadcast engineers to come together. It's a national organization, I should say an international organization, because there are chapters outside of the United States as well. But it's a resource. It's also a lobbying effort to make things better for engineers and for technical things that engineers are involved with. I'm trying to be a little bit light on this, but let's also look at it as a networking opportunity. So over the years, the chapters grew in many communities. SBE Chapter 1 in Binghamton, New York, started there, and that was a group. They got together, they talked about the things they were experiencing. They would bring in manufacturers to show them product, which, remember, when we go back into the 50s, 60s, 70s, a little bit harder. We didn't have the internet at that time to get information and to learn like we can do right now. So SBE has become a predominant organization that also offers certifications. So these certifications can help establish your caliber. And it's like having, I almost want to say it's like having a degree, but it's based on experience and self-study. In most cases, you do have to take a test. The test varies. And you can carry the certification, which when somebody looks at it says, okay, this guy's a real broadcast engineer. What's our effort towards the younger population? Well, many of the members in SBE and many broadcast engineers are older. And this is just the way the business has gone, because with the conversions of IT and how that looks more sexy to a lot of young talent that gets in, they love to play with computers. They started working with computers. And really, we're becoming an IT-based society where we're just so interconnected. And we have gotten there with broadcast as well, and we're bridging that gap. The RF side and some of the technical side of broadcast engineering is less appealing to young students. I want to say high school and college age students, because they don't know what it is. They have not been exposed to it. Early on, back in the day, there were other companies like Radio Shack and Lafayette. They would have electronic kits that people would put together. Nowadays, we have iPhones where people that, Ricky, are your age or younger, are not getting that deep on electronics unless they want to, unless they somehow pick up on it from a family relative or something like that. What we're doing with our SBE chapter is reaching out into the local colleges and local high schools even, and showing them that, hey, this industry is available to you. This is an opportunity, and it doesn't need to be technical in nature. It can be any media. It can be journalistic. We invite you to, you know, join our organization, even if your interest is more journalistic, because you'll meet people, you'll learn something technical, and you will also develop, I want to call it a friend list, you know, or your go-to list of people that you will know the rest of your life. So we've been establishing this for a few years now, pushing on this, obviously, with Andy's work at Hofstra and with his effort as vice chair of our SBE chapter. We've put a big focus on reaching out to high schools and colleges to introduce the opportunities that exist. Some of these schools already have some sort of media program. They may be creating podcasts. Maybe they have a little radio station in there. Maybe they don't. Maybe they just have a program that they're, you know, creating some sort of content and they don't know what to do with it. Some even have TV capability. So we're reaching out to those, and we have a number online now that we work with to present opportunities to show them what the industry is like, to bring them into stations and into media facilities. We have provided tours of radio stations. We have provided tours of the Empire State Building technical infrastructure. So it's making this introduction and letting students know that this is out there. That's very important to us. We've also done this, Andy and I have also done this with our stations, where we dig deep in the local community and get our local high schools involved with providing content on the air too. And we did that with one of our stations in Pike County, Pennsylvania. He does that as well with Red Hook High School. It's creating those opportunities and letting students know, hey, this is out there if you're interested. And what's really valuable is we had a student who had actually graduated, joined SBE. He joined over the summer, came to a couple of meetings, came to the NAB show in New York City in October, and showed up at the holiday luncheon that we had in December. He sat and he met with somebody there that turned into a job interview. Then he had a second interview, and today he's now no longer working for Whole Foods, shopping for other people, but he is working as a broadcast engineer in New York City. So this is what we're looking to do. Again, not just broadcast engineering. It could be content development. It can be the TV side. You know, it doesn't need to be radio.
And you mentioned about those student meetings off the air that's going to be happening at Hofstra University, first Thursday of the month, correct?
Well, so the SB chapter meets monthly on the third Thursday of the month. If you go to sbe15.com, you can see when our meetings are, and there's also a link to sign up for our mailing list, and that's a good way of getting notified of upcoming meetings, and we also send meeting notifications out on social media. But what I was finding with the doing a meeting monthly, and then we were taking 2 months off during the summer, we were taking a summer break, what I found was there's so many more topics that we can cover, so many different things. So what we, Andy and I spoke about this, and I said, let's do another meeting on the first Thursday of the month and directed towards content that may be more suitable or more directed at students. Now, this can be virtual or it can be on site, the same thing that we do with our SBE 15 chapter meetings. They're virtual or they're on site. In our case, we're going to start in February, we're going to start our first Thursday meeting, and anybody can join. You don't have to be a student. Again, it's just the content that we're going to include may be geared more towards students. And it may appeal to our older audience as well. And that's fine. We just want to provide that opportunity. On February 5th, 6 p.m., our first meeting, that first Thursday of the month meeting, we have to come up with an official name for this, will be presented by Radio World Magazine, but the presenter will be Nick Langan, who is a writer. He teaches at Villanova. He developed the Radioland app that you can find on your iPhone or on your Apple device. And I want to call him a genius. He's very, 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 very smart. And he's going to talk about that product that he developed, the history of it, and coding to create apps and what it takes. Because we have had some people that say, hey, I'd like to get into writing games or app development. So we thought this would be a good opportunity for Nick to talk about coding because he has done that. He's written these apps. And I'm looking forward to it as well because there's that mystery of you know, when you download the app on your iPhone or on your Android device, what's behind it? You know, I know the security concerns and the effort you have to go through to get it there. It, you know, you can't just on a whim publish an app like you can just throw up a podcast. There's a little more effort to it. And Nick will go through that. A future meeting that we look to have student-based, one of our first Thursday meetings. This is not confirmed, but we're looking at doing the meeting with Eventide. And Eventide provides a number of plugins on the audio production world, software plugins. And that's where we thought this would be a great opportunity to present what this company provides. And then beyond that, on the third Thursday of February, we are, and again, this is a meeting that students can be attracted to as well, but it's going to help our older membership as well. We have gotten together with SMTE, which is the Society of Motion Picture Television Engineers. I think I've got that right. But recently went to a meeting, an SBE meeting in November down in Baltimore. That was a joint meeting between their SBE chapter and the SMTE chapter. And I said, oh my goodness, we need to do this in New York. So on February 19th, we're going to have an on-site meeting at WPIX in New York City, talking about basically next gen TV, ATSC 3. Right now, TV is digital. It's ATSC 1. That's the technology that's being broadcast. There are stations in New York and around the country and even in some other countries that have converted to ATSC 3. So we're doing this joint meeting to provide more content for those interested on the TV side, the technical side, as well as they're going to talk about some of the content. And again, this is an on-site meeting, so there will be an opportunity to see what they do and what it's like at PIX.
There was something interesting that you guys did in an SBE meeting one night, where it was about how broadcasting is a public service and when an emergency happens, how the radio stations and TV stations can respond. And even you talked about before about the community engagement. Why do you think broadcasting, whether it be radio or television, specifically local, is such a public service and an important thing to have for the local communities?
There can be relationships at the local level. Communicating about emergencies and issues going on in a community and our local news coverage that we have. In other words, we have local news on Wall Radio, a guy that's been in the market forever. So he knows everybody. He knows the newsmakers. He knows when there's a story that needs to be told. And if there's something that's important that people need to be aware of. We also have relationships with mayors. We have relationships with the police departments, with emergency management in the county, so with county government as well, so that if there's a message that needs to be disseminated to the public, we will do that as well. They'll use social media. They'll use other methods of communication as well. But if that's not available, radio is another path for which to deliver messages to our audiences. And I'll give you an example, and this is something we need to watch for in the future. When Hurricane Sandy came through, it knocked out a lot of cell coverage, a lot of wireless coverage. So it was broadcast stations that people were listening to and getting a lot of their information from because their cell phones in certain areas were not working. Now, granted, the cell systems are more robust since Sandy here in the Northeast, but there is still that risk. And we have had some outages occur that take down a cellular network. Radio is so simple. I don't want to say we could just plug a microphone into a transmitter and go. A little more complex than that, but it is almost as simple as that. It's much simpler in being able to deliver information to a smaller community. We also have the emergency alert system, EAS, which comes down from the federal government, is another source of providing emergency information. And that's what I call a voluntary requirement. And it's something we're more than happy to do, because if there's a incident of a chemical spill or something like that, EAS will help in disseminating that information across many different methods as well. So, and radio is one of those methods that can be very reliable.
Do you, my question, do you feel like the impact of community radio, it's still at the level where it was meant to be, where it's communicating directly to the community?
So it depends on the community, and it depends on how much effort is put into it. I say that realizing that your community station is different than what I consider my community station, Wall Radio, or what Andy's station, WKZE, is, because we're commercially licensed. But we consider ourselves community because we focus on servicing and serving the needs of that listening audience and the business community, as well as organizations. So there are a lot of people that have gotten away from realizing that this is available, but there are some communities that realize we're still there. We always have to promote ourselves and tell us we are that resource that you can come to for information, for knowledge, for music, for news, for comfort. And we still have, is it still strong? Yes. It depends on the community, because there are some larger communities that it's more difficult to penetrate. But success, I've seen a lot of success in many of the smaller communities once you get away from the metropolitan areas, where there isn't a very good source of information and entertainment that is locally focused.
So now, obviously, we're in the technocratic era where everything is being used is technology. What do you think of, you know, the future of podcasting, especially at the community level, where now you can program AI to even mimic voices, to mimic, you know, interaction, or simulate it to a point where it sounds super real on radio, as if it's a person who's interacting with the audience? Do you think that will disconnect community or will disconnect humanity when it comes to content creating that is focusing on the things that the community needs?
So I think there needs to be a dividing point of where we use AI as a voice over the air. We have used an AI-created voice in our stations when we have needed an additional voice, let's say for a commercial message, but we have not used AI to try to be a host. Now, that technology is there. There are companies that are developing that. I will not embrace that technology, because I want our hosts to be human. And I want, this is what I want, this is my view, you asked for my view, I want that connection with our listeners, our human listeners, to be from one human to another. AI has a place. As an example, we will embrace it on my stations. We're looking at using it to help us deliver newscasts that we've already written the script for, again, just so we can have another voice, and traffic reports. But that would be all we would do. We would not want to create or put a non-human on the air to try to be that relationship with the listener. Early on, I spoke about how we want to create that relationship between our on-air hosts and the listeners and the businesses, because they're all making this, this is all the fabric of the station. And I believe because that human contact is there, that human is in the market, in the community, and can get involved in those local events and with those local listeners, that to me is paramount to the survival of community radio and what you guys are doing there. As well as what many other community stations do around the country, here in the States and around the world.
Okay, so now we're in 2026, the year, I feel like this is the year of information where everything is put out there, but obviously with via social media, which is nowadays is becoming the first medium to break out news. Where do you think the community media is? Are we falling behind based on your knowledge or based on what you do? Are we falling behind when it comes to breaking news or storytelling of what's happening around the world? We've seen it with the Ukraine issue. We've seen it with Venezuela and the U.S. We've seen it with Africa on Sudan conflicts and all that. Still, I feel like there's still the information is being, you know, chosen which part should be told within all these stories. How is community media playing a role in that sense?
Wow. And I love the question because where do I start? So and it's unrehearsed. So when we provide information, I'm going to use our stations as an example. We use CBS News, CBS News Radio News, which is different than CBS TV. And we don't take a political position over the air. But there's a reason why I'm saying this. Same thing with our local news, although we have political parties that we have to report on both sides of. Social media has gotten to the point where it can be so polarized in one direction or another. That news, that information can get out there very quickly from social media, and it may be either true, partially true, or totally inaccurate, but it gets posted out there because there's, let's say, no filter. Where community radio and what we do is, I think, better because we could be stewards of providing unbiased opinion, or I don't even want to say opinion. I just want to say unbiased information, because we want our listenership, we want to provide a service where they make their opinions based on what we provide, but we don't want to provide inaccurate information. So we compete with these other sources that are going to perhaps get information out quicker and maybe in more detail. But we want to be trusted so that when you're listening to our stations, our community stations, you're hearing information that is accurate and is meaningful to the audience. Now, this extends beyond just the on-air product, because as you know, in any business now, you have to have a social media presence. You've got to have an online presence. So we take our station, Wall Radio, as an example, and Andy's station, KZE, has an online presence. And we talk about things we do on the air. So our connection with the audience isn't just verbally or orally over the air, or if you're listening on the stream, but it's also through reading content that we post. And it's up to us to keep that content relevant, accurate, and well-serving our community.
Thanks. And then 2026, where do you see the future of the medium?
I see it growing as long as we remember it's all about content. The better the content we provide will differentiate us from everything else out there. Yes, you can go listen to a Spotify playlist, but what if you can listen to that music you like and then hear local information or more information even about the music, about what's happening locally, about what's going on in local schools? Many of our listeners are parents. Their children are listening as well. This is the direction we need to really focus on, is making sure that our content is focused properly on the audience, and that will differentiate ourselves.
And the last part now, what would you like to say to our listener of One World Radio, especially in these different countries and obviously the continent of Africa?
Yeah, as I said to Ricky earlier, I'm a radio guy. I believe in this method of communication, in the relationship that radio creates. And radio is not just that device that sits on a table. It is a living, breathing thing that's made up of people that create this content. Continue to do that, because you don't know how important you really are in providing accurate, localized information and content and keeping communities together by promoting events. That is my message. Stay focused on your community and what their needs are, and just embrace what you've got. You've got an ability to reach this audience. Continue to put the best content you can up there to serve their needs. Ask them what they're looking for. Involve them to get on the air, to work somehow with your stations as well. We need to keep this group going. We need to keep broadcasting going. And this is the best way to do it, because it'll be more accurate. It'll be more locally focused. You'll be able to touch your listeners much better. Hey, Ricky, can we talk about 85X for a sec or what?
Yes, but before you go, very quickly, tease this project. Kusi, I think you'll appreciate this. Tease the 85X project that we're working on.
So Hudson Valley Public Radio is actually taking a donation of a radio station in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And as part of HVPR, Andy and I came up with a plan of what we can do with that station and how it can survive out there. We researched the market. We went out there. We asked a lot of questions. We met with community leadership. We have a model that we believe can work. It takes time to put all of this together. We have to get FCC consent for the assignment of the broadcast license. And we still have a few things to work through. But the fact that Hudson Valley Public Radio is getting this signal is public knowledge. And there are some message boards that even picked up on it. And there are people talking about it. We've gotten some press about it. One thing that we did is we created, I don't want to call it a stunt because it has grown into something, a lot of fun. We created 85X. And if you go to waxb.org, you will be able to hear a radio station. Now, it's not broadcasting over the air right now. It's only on a stream. You should go look at it and listen to it. This is really Andy's brainchild. I call him our chief idea officer. We call it open source as well. If anybody wants to contribute content to it, we will put that on the air as well. But it plays everything, a lot of different music from Yacht Rock to Grateful Dead to some current music. I don't want to spoil the surprise. Go to the website, waxb.org, take a look at it and enjoy it. And this is something that we may just keep alive after we launch WAXB with our intended format, just because it's getting a lot of listenership and it's a lot of fun.
I'll definitely check it out. It sounds like an outreach program that is helping the community. I'm loving it.
It's more, it's we're having fun with it. It's just a matter to have fun and the show radio. Hey, you can be different.
Thank you, Bud, very much for coming on.
Yeah.
If people want to listen to any of your stations, where can they find you?
Wallradio.com, WDLCcountry.com, thepike1069.com, waxb.org right now for our 85X experiment. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention WKZE.com.
Thank you, Bud.
All right, take care, guys.
You've been listening to the One Road Community Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU, Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM, Bush Radio, the mother of community radio in Cape Town, South Africa. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle. Reach the eye.
So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh, you have no excuse not to listen.
Reach the island.
So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program.